Welcome to episode 12 of the Racquetball Show podcast. On this episode, I do an instructional segment on footwork and then bring on Todd Boss of ProRacquetballStats.com to discuss a variety of things, statistic things, but also just the game in general. One note that I wanted to say before getting into anything, somebody asked me at National Singles, actually, if I keep this podcast intentionally anonymous by not putting my name out there. And the answer is no. My name is Dylan Reed. I'm not hiding that fact. It's just so happens that that never comes up naturally throughout the podcast. I don't refer to myself in the third person often. But I didn't want to make this podcast about me, and that's the reason I didn't put my name everywhere on it. But I don't want to hide the fact that this is me doing the podcast. So I just wanted to say that in case anybody was left out in the dark, and feel free to reach out to me on social media, friend request me, please don't stalk me, but you can reach out to me in a variety of ways, particularly Dylan at racquetballshow.com, and I love to hear feedback and everything from you guys who are listening. I appreciate it from every one of you. Without further ado, let's get into the podcast.
Serving 10, must win by 2 points.
It is absolute pandemonium here.
I will be the greatest player to ever play the game.
Anybody who won't die for it
shouldn't be playing.
Get that ball. Get the ball.
I wanted to take a quick moment to plug one of my sponsors, Gearbox Racquetball. Now, full disclosure, Gearbox sponsors me as a player, so of course, you know, sponsoring me on this podcast makes total sense, and I wouldn't sponsor any other brand, but I choose Gearbox for a reason. I think they're a fantastic brand. They provide top-of-the-line racquetball equipment, really anything you need, rackets, eye guards, gloves, bags, and all the other accessories that you might need. And as a listener of this podcast, I'm sure you guys already know that. You're aware of all the brands out there because probably if you're listening to this, you're pretty darn into racquetball. So I just wanted to take a moment to plug Gearbox because I think they not only provide awesome products, but they do an awesome job of promoting racquetball. And they have amazing customer service, and everyone you interact with on the Gearbox team is an awesome person. At least that's what I've found in my experience. So if you're in the market for racquetball equipment, I would advise that you check out Gearbox. You can check them out at gearboxsports.com. Welcome to the latest instructional segment. So for this segment, we are going to be going through some of my thoughts on footwork. So footwork, why is footwork important? So to me, I think one way of simplifying the game of racquetball, or one way of thinking about it as a game on the whole, is you want to always make sure that you are in a better position than your opponent, right? You want to be dominating center court, and you want to be making each of your shots or each of your opportunities easier than those of your opponent. So think of when you're dropping and hitting the ball or when you have easy setups. That is a much better shot opportunity than when you're off balance or when you're backing up hitting a ball or when you're jammed, for example. Like when you think of basketball, a much better opportunity is a wide open corner three jump shot. That's much better than a long two that's contested, right? So you want to be making sure that you have great opportunities, and footwork is a way of getting you there. Players with great footwork make the game look easy. They're rarely off balance or jammed, and they're often hitting the ball at an easy position. So, what is good footwork? Oftentimes, I think people think of footwork as simply having quick feet. And in my opinion, while foot quickness is one element of good footwork, what's more important is the efficiency of one's footwork. So, you can think of this like efficiency versus effectiveness in business, where efficiency would be doing one thing really quickly or well, but it doesn't necessarily mean you're doing the right thing to put yourself in a position to be successful. So you might be answering email really quickly, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you are doing the things that are going to have the biggest impact on your business. So now let's go through through some concepts that I think will have a major impact on how you think about footwork and that you can implement to have better footwork in your game. So the first thing is to eliminate wasted movement. So for example, an example of wasted movement would be when you go to originally step to the ball, when you first see the ball in motion and you step to it, people often take a false step. In other words, if you should be taking your first step as a long lunge step with your right foot, and the first thing that you do is your left foot drops back so that your right foot can move forward, that's a false step, and that's wasted movement that's costing you time and distance away from the ball. So watch yourself on film and look at where you might be making wasted movements. Another thing is that people often take big crossover steps, and that's oftentimes not necessary, and that's putting you in bad positions. So when you're getting to a ball and your foot is crossed over, in other words, it's making you your back face the front wall in a way, or you're stepping toward the side wall, that is putting you in a bad position because you're in this closed stance where after you swing, it's much harder to get back to center court, and you can't see your opponent when you are swinging. When you're able to see your opponent, you can see where they're positioned and you can make the smartest shot possible based on where they're positioned. When you're crossed over, you can't see where they are, so you are kind of blind to where your opponent's at, and you're much less likely to make an intelligent shot. Another thing is proper weight distribution on your feet. I think this is something that not a lot of people think about, but making sure that your foot, that your weight is on the center or inside of your feet rather than pushing off and having the weight on the outside of your feet is very important, just in the sense that it will force you to use the bigger muscles in your legs rather than inefficiently using the smaller muscles that are less powerful. Another thing is backpedaling to balls in the backcourt. I think a lot of people are taught the shuffle to everything idea, and while many balls you do want to shuffle, and having the ability to shuffle powerfully is a great thing, moving to balls in the backcourt, it's much more efficient to backpedal to the backcourt. So if you're in center court, you want to backpedal straight back and then banana route over. So make a curved route over to balls that are in either the back left or back right corner. And when someone broke this down on film for me, it became obvious that this is a much more efficient and effective route. You take less steps to get to that ball. The last thing I want to go through is adjustment steps. So oftentimes a player will move their feet generally to where they think the ball will land. So they want to move their feet so that the ball is in their power zone. The ball passes through a zone where it's right behind their front knee, in the place that they're most comfortable with the ball. But they don't always calibrate it right when they take those big steps to get there. And you want to be taking tiny adjustment steps so that when you realize I'm in my close enough position, I'm 90% of the way there, you want to be taking adjustment steps to make sure that you are moving to be precisely where you want to be hitting the ball. Not just close enough, but precisely hitting the ball right where you want it. That's a big difference between someone who is hitting the ball with a great opportunity versus someone who's hitting the ball with a good opportunity. Finally, what are some drills you can do to work on your footwork? So some things that I work on are the star drill, and I think I learned this from Fran Davis at a camp of hers, but the star drill is essentially you start in center court and then you shuffle to each of six spots, so front left, front right, middle left, middle right, back left, back right, and you go from center court to each of those positions each time. And I like to do this with a ball so that I'm hitting the ball at each position and I just hit it back to myself and then catch the ball and then shuffle back to center court after each time. And I think that's a great way of getting in work that is sport specific. So it relates exactly to what you're going to be doing on the racquetball court. Similarly, I like to just do side-to-side shuffles with swings because I think more often than not, you're moving side-to-side rather than up. The front left and front right movements aren't happening as often, and it's not as crucial that you nail those movements so much as it is crucial that you nail the side-to-side movement and do that as efficiently and effectively as possible. And then finally, backcourt setups. So I like to hit setups for myself that end up in the back left and back right corners. Essentially, I'll start. It's important that you start in center court and then hit the ball to the back left and back left, back right corners. So a ceiling ball or a lob or whatever. And then shuffle back with what I was talking about, the back pedaling and the banana route, which is something that I learned later on in my career, so to speak. And I had to do a bunch of repetitions of that to finally start nailing the footwork and get it ingrained in my mind unconsciously rather than having to think about it within a match. I had to just do that over and over again to finally nail that footwork. And then finally, a drill you can work on is ladder drills. Me personally, I don't work on ladder drills, but I know that ladder drills have been effective for some people. I've heard that ladder drills simply help you get better at ladder drills and don't actually help you get better at racquetball footwork. So I haven't gotten as into them, but I know great players who work on ladder drills often and have had great results with their footwork. So hopefully that helps, guys. Reach out if you have any questions. Watch video on what great players are doing because it might not be obvious, but hopefully having now heard of these concepts, you can break down what great players are doing and how footwork is allowing them to be so successful and what specifically they're doing with their feet to put them in a position to be so successful. All right. That's all I got on footwork. Thanks for listening. Again, feel free to reach out at Dylan@racquetballshow.com if you have any questions. The Racquetball Show is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, vegetarians, and racquetball players get lower rates on their life insurance. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people. Health IQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. To see if you qualify, to learn more, or to get a free quote on life insurance, you can visit healthiq.com/TRS. Link in the podcast description. This is a great way of supporting the podcast and of potentially getting great savings on your life insurance. Check them out. I am here with Todd Boss, who is the creator of the website and Facebook group Pro Racquetball Stats. You can visit that at www.prorackabballstats.com, all spelled out. Todd, thank you for joining me. The first thing I wanted to get into, actually, let's get into your background a little bit. In case people don't know you too well, what is your background?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you again. My background, I first got introduced to racquetball when I took it as my PE in college back in 1990. I live in the Washington, D.C. area, so I've been played tournaments in the area from the mid-90s to the late 2000s. I was a club pro for about 10 years in Arlington, Virginia. And the genesis of this website or genesis of this research essentially happened because I was in the racquetball community, and at that time, you know, you were close enough to the heyday of racquetball where you still would come into contact with people that talked about the Hogan Brumfeld or the Yellen years. And I came to find out that there was some controversy about who won the pro title, and specifically in 1977 and 1982. And that kind of dumbfounded me because, you know, this is a pro sport with that has followers and a point system, presumably. And so how could there have been a question about who won the tournament? And so that's, I ended up starting to try to reach out and started to talk to people. And then one thing led to another. And I got my hands on an archive of match results. And I'm a database consultant by trade. And so I figured that I could turn that into something that I could put online and put a search engine on it. And that's essentially how the site started. And so that all began in the 2004 timeframe. And so since that point, I've just been keeping up with data and adding more data, adding more reports. And now we are where we are today.
Yeah. And just to fill the listeners in, Todd said, thank you for having me again, because I had him on once and the audio failed to record. Totally my fault. but Todd was a great sport and I appreciate, you know, you come jumping back on and joining me again.
You bet.
And it should record this time. We'll see. All right. So a thing I want to get into that recently happened, Kane Wasilenchuk just recently announced that he is retiring from professional racquetball, or at least 90% sure that he's doing so. What were your thoughts on that announcement?
Well, for one, it really surprised me. I one of the things that I've noticed by tracking pro racquetball over the years is that, by and large, these pro players end up petering out or retiring in their early 30s. It's kind of similar to tennis. You don't see too many pro tennis players that are successful past that age. But if you look at what Kane and Karaki and Alvaro have been doing lately, you know, they're all in their late 30s, and yet they're still at the top of the game, which is kind of an interesting point. So we always knew that these guys were eventually going to kind of peter out, become overcome by injuries or just get to a point where their bodies couldn't hold up. You know, none of us can outrace time. But I honestly never thought that it would be Kane that would bow out first. You look at his accomplishments, he's still essentially undefeated. You know, I think he dropped two games this entire past season, and they were both at the U.S. Open, where, in my opinion, he didn't look like he was totally 100%, you know, especially in the final. So it just kind of shocked me that he decided to bow at this time. I look at the competition that he's facing. I think that he could have easily run off a couple more seasons. You look at what he's been saying, and by the way, we're reporting this on Monday the 14th, and he just announced that he's doing a Facebook interview in a couple of days, so
yep.
Maybe he'll open up and talk about what exactly is on his mind. So that's kind of like my initial thoughts.
Yeah, what would you theorize as to the why he decided to retire?
Well, he's made some comments in the past about how he never wants to have he never wanted to have his kids see him lose, and not that I think he's in danger of losing, but you know, and I said this in my little career retrospective post I did on Facebook a little while back after he announced, but it's not too many people that can say that they won their last match, you know, like Pete Sampras won the U.S. Open and then he retired, and that's exceedingly rare, especially in a sport where it's an individual type sport and an individual accomplishment. And so it just could have been a case where he wanted to go out on top. You know, there's right after the announcement came, as you know, in the racquetball communities that we follow on Facebook, there was a ton of, kind of armchair analysis. Like, why did he do this? Is this good for the sport? Is this good for the tour? Blah, blah, blah. I don't know Kane personally. I can't speculate. I wasn't at the tournament. You know, I heard some things. There's these innuendos or rumors about maybe something happened at the tournament. Who knows? You know, I think that we need to hear it from Kane's mouth and give him the benefit of the doubt. Just on a personal level, I'll say this. Half the queries that I've written were basically written to highlight his amazing accomplishments. And so I'll miss that. And, you know, on the women's side, you know, Paola has a ton of accomplishments as well that you know, in terms of win streaks and, you know, perfect seasons and whatnot. But it was really Kane that drove a lot of that. And so in that respect, I'm going to miss it.
Yeah, totally. And you talk about those stats. Could you take us through? Because there, I saw you do a kind of a mega post on the most amazing Kane stats. Could you take us through some of your favorite ones? Because there are some pretty impressive Kane racquetball stats.
So I think, so for one, when he went the season without dropping a game, I thought that at that point that that was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in the sport. He had a perfect season in the past, which hadn't been done before that. You know, the closest before that would have been Marty Hogan's 76-77 season. But then about halfway through that season, I kind of noticed it. Like, I can't remember, because I didn't have a query written to show, like, consecutive game streaks at that time. And I ended up writing one because I wanted to see, well, how many games in a row did he win? He eventually compiled, and I'm looking for my notes from that little post that I did. So in his 100, he had 134 match win streak on the court, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. But the game streak in particular, he won 113 consecutive games.
Not bad.
And, I mean, that is just amazing. You know, and included in that was his streak where he went the entire season. So that, I think, is actually only my second favorite stat about him. I think you mentioned some of them in the previous podcast when you were chatting with Tim. But for me, his most amazing stat is right now he sits with a career record of 553 wins and 50 losses. So that's a .917 winning percentage. He's so far ahead of the second player in terms of a career win-loss percentage, who's Marty Hogan at a .844, that Kane could lose 50 straight matches and still be in the lead in terms of career win-loss percentage. He would 50 straight matches and he'd still have the best career. That is, to me, the most astounding stat that I could think of for his accomplishments.
Yeah, that's totally absurd. So what are some of your other favorite statistics, if you were to take us through some that maybe aren't Kane-related but other favorite stats?
So one of the most amazing things that I've seen, and again, this was kind of like, I have a donut query in here. Kane actually has been donut a few times in his career, three times to be exact. But Miss Paola Longoria has never been donutted in her pro career. She's given 107 out. She's never taken one. And what's interesting about that is that she lost the last final on the Ladies Pro Tour, and in the final game, Samantha was darn close to giving her a donut, but she ended up picking up a point or two at the very end. And I remember just kind of listening along as that was happening. I was like, oh man, I wonder if she's gonna lose that particular record. But I don't know. Some of the other interesting. I have a bunch of age-related reports that are kind of cool to watch. You know, for anybody who doesn't know who Ruben Gonzalez is, you know, if you go to the site and run the report called Oldest Players 2, it's essentially a career retrospective on how amazing Ruben was. He's the oldest guy to win a tournament. He won a tournament at the age of 40. He's the oldest guy to win the Pro Tour, which he won in his mid-30s. Oldest player to make a final, oldest player to make a semifinal. He made a semi at the age of 49, which is pretty amazing. He is the oldest guy to make a quarter at the age of 53, and he made a bunch of 16s his final year of touring when he was nearly 60 years old.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
So these are all kind of stats that occur looking at, you know, it's kind of just games, wins and losses. If there could be statistics that were in a particular game, right, like percentage of serves in or out, percentage of forced errors versus unforced errors, I know that would be a bit hard to record, but what would you think would be some good statistics in that realm?
Well, so if you could get, you know, so I tried once to get like some in-game stats, and I created a little construct to track games, and the problem was that it just took forever. You couldn't do it in a real-time fashion. It was too difficult to have, you know, because the rallies are so fast and furious, and you have a first serve, and then there's a rally, and then there's a, you know, the two-shot rally, and there's a kill shot. And if you try to track, you know, was it a drive serve? Was it a lob serve? Was it a kill shot? Was it an error? Was it a forehand, a backhand? It's almost impossible to track in real-time. You know, and so it's too bad because we know that other sports, you know, like tennis, where there's a ton more money, has stuff like, or baseball, which has StatCast, has the ability to do more real-time tracking on this. And you know, and so if I was a coach, I could get this real-time information and then immediately be able to pass it along to my players. In racquetball, you know, you just don't have that. I'm sure that racquetball could do StatCast. However, it's just impossible to do it right now.
So you're able to look at Kane's career and say how dominant he is and look at other top players throughout their careers. Have you found a good way to evaluate historically who the best player of all time or like an overall historical ranking of the top players?
I unfortunately no. You know, it's kind of like looking at heavyweight boxers, you know. Mm-hmm. And the parable that I always used to say was, you know, there's only been one heavyweight champion that ever retired undefeated. And that was Rocky Marciano, or maybe it was Colavito. Rocky something. Anyway, But then you ask boxing aficionados, and they'll never say that he was the best ever, right? So everything is kind of era contextually related.
Yeah.
And so when you ask a lot of these guys, it's just all observational analysis and opinion based. If you talk to some of the old guys, you know, say like a Steve Keeley, who is still really kind of really active on Facebook. You know, he's going to pitch for the old guys. And if you talk to someone like me, and I struggled with this for a long time because I grew up watching, you know, Cliff and Sudsy. And I was like, oh, well, Cliff and Sudsy are the best. And so anybody now who's just only been experiencing Kane, you know, suffers from recency bias. And they say, okay, well, Kane's got to be the best. In reality, and what's interesting is that a lot of these guys, they overlap, right? So the first real champion was Charlie Brumfield. But then his career overlapped with Hogan. And then after Hogan, Yellen had a stretch. And so Hogan and Yellen kind of overlapped. And then Cliff came onto the scene. And so interestingly, you know, these guys all played each other. They all have head-to-heads. And so one of the interesting things you can do is in the site is to look at head-to-head records and try to just draw some conclusions. So, for example, speaking of career overlaps, so Kane and Cliff played – I think 21 times, and Kane holds a 13-9 career record over Cliff. Okay, well, that's good, except that Kane's 15 years younger than Cliff, so he's got kind of an inherent advantage there. But in the meantime, if I looked at Hogan versus Cliff, you know, Hogan, who was significantly younger than Cliff, I think by 10 years, Hogan had a winning career record over Cliff. So even though there was that age difference. So that's one of these interesting things. To answer the question, I think you have to look at the eras of the sport. You know, at the very beginning, where most of the racquetball players were converted paddleball guys and they were playing with these, you know, 12 and a half inch rackets and a slow ball, was a significantly different sport than the one that Hogan came to popularize. And then in the mid 80s, when the rackets went from 12 to 14 to 21 inches or whatever, you know, that's really where that's essentially been the game that we've seen since. And there's been kind of waves of, you know, so after Cliff and Sudsy's era, you know, but kind of before Clint Kane took over, there was definitely an era of control. You know, so the likes of, you know, Carson and Jack and Menino, I think you can classify them all as like control players. Whereas obviously Kane's is a huge power player and has kind of defined this era. But at the end of the day, if you ask somebody, they're going to say, well, I think that Charlie's the best because that's who they saw when they were learning how to play.
Yeah. It's hard to compare eras. I would also say that, you know, you might think of Rocky and, you said Rocky, Jack, and, Jason Menino as control players. I don't know that you'd be saying that if there weren't a Kane though. Like,
no, that's true.
They still hit the ball pretty hard. I mean, I've played Rocky. He's very powerful. But know, when you have, you know, a guy who just dominates them with power.
No, it's true. You know, like, so probably the quintessential control player that we've seen outside of the very beginnings of the sport was probably Mike Gray. You know, everyone talks about how smooth he was, and, you know, he's a lefty, and, you know, he would just control the games. But he could hit the ball hard. He put the ball down. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So if you were to just, I mean, I guess it's very hard to statistically make a definitive ranking, but if you were to just give your own personal subjective ranking, what would you historically say, like, is the top five players of all time?
Well, so luckily for you, I have this.
There we go.
You know, so there, if you go back in the magazines, there's a bunch of draws of the century or draws of history. And so I've got my own personal one. And here's how I would seed it, 1 to 16. You ready?
Let's do it.
Kane, Cliff, Marty, Sudsy. Then Yellen, Harnett, Brumfield, Jack, Husek. That was your top eight.
Okay.
Then I'd go Menino, Roberts, Dave Peck, Rocky, John Ellis, Mike Ray, Ruben, and Hellacher. And so then just missing out would be the likes of Catchstick, Doyle, Rich Wagner, Steve Strandemo, Alvaro, Steve Keeley, Greg Peck, Ed Andrews, right?
Okay.
So then if I played this all out, though, and I, you know, I think that a couple years ago, I still would have held on to the belief that it would come down to a Kane-Cliff final, you know, with Swain beating him, but not anymore. I think that the last few years of Kane's career with these game streaks and this ridiculous dominance has cemented it for me. Even someone who grew up in the 90s and always thought that Cliff was the best. You know, now I don't think anybody can make the argument that Kane's not the greatest that's ever played.
Yeah, that's my opinion personally. And I am one of those guys who I've seen Kane play a ton more than the guys from previous eras. So it's a bit unfair for me to say that. So I'm glad you're, you know, as the stat guy, I'm glad you side with me.
I will say this, though. You asked me before about, you know, overrated and underrated players.
Yeah.
I will say this. You know, we always hear about Marty Hogan, right? And I talked a little bit before about overlapping careers. If you go look at Marty's head-to-head record, so his career overlapped with three or four of the major, you know, milestone pros in our sports history. Charlie Brumfield, Cliff Swain, Mike Yellen. He has winning career records against all those guys. So he came up and he beat the old champ to take over the crown. And then even as Yellen was winning five straight titles, Marty had a better career record than him. He won more tournaments from 83 to 87 than Yellen did, and yet somehow finished behind him all 5 years in the rankings. Marty had a better winning record against Cliff. Marty was 25 against Dave Peck, who beat him for the title in 82. So people forget just how good Marty was sometimes.
Yeah, good to know. Are there any other players you look at and you particularly see them as overrated or underrated?
I think that partially because it's so long ago, but I think that we end up underrating the pioneers of the sport. So Brumfield, Hellacher, maybe even the guys like Strandemo and Surratt at the very beginning, Schmicke and Schultz, you know, Schultz is the guy who won the first ever racquetball national title in 68. Underrated, Brett Harnett. You know, he was dominant on it. He holds the record, I believe, for the youngest to, I think he, the youngest to win a tournament in Pro Tour history, outside of Surratt, who basically started the Pro Tour in 74. And what's funny is that Harnett was just getting ready to come in and dominate right when pro racquetball just utterly fell apart in the late 80s. And so that really cost him because, you know, he probably should have won the pro title in 89 when the tour disintegrated. And then in 90, you know, there wasn't really that many events. So, and then throughout the mid-80s, he was winning tournaments. And there's a couple of those years where you look at the overall results and you just, like, how did Harnett not win a year-end title? On the flip side, you know, maybe, and you hate to say this about a five-time champ, but, you know, was Mike Yellen a little bit overrated? You know, he won five year-end titles, and he was one of racquetball's only million-dollar guys. But consistently throughout that time period, he just did enough to win the title. But I don't think anyone would look at his competitions with Hogan and say that Yellen was a better player than Hogan. So it's kind of an oddity in our sport.
Interesting. So, Todd, through your years in the sport, do you have a favorite or a favorite few racquetball stories?
Well, I got a better story for you than the last time we talked.
Okay, I like it. All right.
I once got matched up with Ruben Gonzalez in a tournament. I drove up to Towson, Maryland. And so at the time, Ruben lived in New York. And so it was an easy drive for him to come down. I show up and I'm scheduled to play him in the first match. I mean, he's like the draw in this tournament. And I'm just this lowly, you know, barely into open tournament player. So I get out on the court with him and I'm jacked up. I'm overhyped. I'm full of adrenaline. And I just start hitting as hard as I can. And so I'm overhitting. And so as a result, I'm missing my lines. And instead of hitting balls to the corner, I'm hitting waist-high balls in the middle of the court that keep basically hitting Ruben. Like I was hitting such bad shots that he couldn't return them. So all of a sudden in the first game, I'm up on him like 11-2. And he calls timeout. And basically the entire tournament is sitting here watching this. And one of the guys comes down. He's like, if you beat Ruben Gonzalez, you're going to be a legend. Yeah, I don't think I scored again in that game because Ruben got into the box and he started hitting this little cut jam serve. And he, you know, right over the line, bounces off, ace, ace, ace. He aced me three times on the forehand side, switched around, aced me three times on the backhand side, and I was done. He just totally controlled the match from there on out. And what's interesting about that is, like, I watched Ruben play a lot, and, you know, he would always play like that. He would always kind of just he never was like even when Kane is playing in a first round, he's trying to win 0-0-0. Ruben was more interested in just, you know, being a showman and kind of playing to the crowd and giving people a good show. And so maybe he was letting me get up on him 11-2, but that was one of my favorite experiences on the court.
Yeah, that's awesome. That when I had in college, I had a couple roommates who didn't play racquetball at all. They came out and saw me play once, and then they're just jokingly, they were like, "Hey, you know, you're trying to beat these guys by trying to hit the ball low and hard, and that's what everybody does. Maybe just be creative and try hitting it like soft and high." And I was like, you know, guys, I appreciate the creativity, but I don't know that'd work. But good to know it had a little success for you.
Absolutely.
And you did tell one that I liked before, though. Could you retell your Alvaro story?
Oh, so okay. So I'm at the U.S. Open. It was either 02 or 03. And so we're in Memphis. And for those of you that never saw that place, the show court was kind of up against one wall of like a big sunken tennis court, and then there was the racquetball courts were on the other side of the room, and then alongside one of them was a media room. So I was in there. I would go and like write dailies for Ganim and, you know, for the little newsletter they published. So I'm sitting in the media room, and there was a moth on the court right there, and Alvaro was playing on the court. So somebody's like, "Hey, Alvi, can you go and get rid of that moth?" And so he's standing there at 39 feet. Gets the ball, drop, hits, and he nails the moth, first shot. just, you know, like he'd done it a million times. Amazing hand-eye coordination.
Yeah, that's awesome. I like to imagine that's how he learned to play, just hitting random different bugs he wanted to kill or, you know, whatever, hitting the light switch or something.
Yeah.
So, Todd, from maybe a statistical standpoint, but maybe also from just having watched a bunch of racquetball, who would you say is likely to be the next number one? And I guess this question, you know, with Kane out of the picture, theoretically, it has to be somebody other than Kane. But who do you think will win the tour this year?
So assuming Kane is 90% retired and doesn't play enough, I think that Alejandro Landa is going to take it. And I say that for two reasons. You know, the last time that they played, you know, Rocky got Alejandro in order to essentially sew up this past year's title. But the two times previously, Landa beat him. And, you know, Landa's very consistent, and Landa has been consistently beating all of the other top competitors. He's now, I believe, 6-3 against Daniel Del Rosa head-to-head across the various, you know, whether it be IRT or amateur matches. And so... And I say this because I just have a feeling that Rocky, who's now, I believe, going to be 39. Don't quote me on that, Rocky. 38 or 39 this coming year. I just can't believe that Rocky's going to make it another year without suffering, you know, some nagging injuries. Meanwhile, Landa's right in his prime. And so I think what's going to happen is that if Rocky was 100% healthy, I think that's how it would go, 1-2. But I think Landa's going to win enough of these events. He was very consistent this year. You know, he won two events, lost a third final, made three other semis. Whereas Rocky couldn't say that. Rocky took a bunch of early losses, very uncharacteristic for him. And I think that's what it's going to come down to.
Yeah. What about, so over the next, say, 10 years, who would you expect to be the most dominant player? And maybe it doesn't have to be dominant in the way that Kane was, where they're winning absolutely every tournament and winning easily. But who do you think will be kind of the player of this next generation?
I think that it'll be I think it'll be one of three guys who are all essentially in their young, and they're all in the 21 to 23 range. I think it's going to either be De La Rosa, Montoya, or Faria. I like Montoya's game. You know, he has a great drive serve. He's the most athletic person I've seen on the court since Jason Menino in terms of just get ability. And it just seems that, you know, what's holding him back is just finances. You know, he's not playing, he doesn't play the tour regularly, but when he does come out and play, he makes the quarters or the semis, and he gets wins. Montoya's beaten Landa the last couple times that they played him. He's got winning records head to head over Perea, you know, so these are, you know, see, he's getting good. And by the way, he's the same age as Perea. And so they played each other in juniors, like practically every year for like the last decade. And he's always kind of just had Perea's, you know, number, it seems. But everything that I just said is kind of predicated on, okay, is De La Rosa going to keep playing? You know, you interviewed him, and it seemed like he was ready to, you know, ready to hang it up and go play golf, you know, sooner than later. You know, Perea is a nut. He's playing like all these different events. You know, he was down in Costa Rica last weekend, and you know, and he played almost every IRT and every WRT event this year. You know, so good for him. So maybe, and he won an event, you know, so that means that he's got the ability to beat these guys. Past those three, you know, I like Jake and Bobby. I think that they're both in the same boat. They are both improving players. You know, Bobby looked fantastic this past weekend, getting wins over, in order, Perea, Landa, and then Beltran to win that title. Those are tough wins. And he looked crisp and he looked solid. And I wonder if he's not going to make a run. You know, he snuck into the top 10 at the very end of the last season. If he gets a protected 8 seed, I think that's going to do numbers. Huge, huge benefit for him on the IRT Tour.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of guys also who haven't been able to really attend tournaments, and that's, I'd say, Conrado Moscoso. He really impressed me at the U.S. Open and impressed just about everybody, I think. And then Kobe Uwasa, who we haven't seen much of, but I saw him play a tournament up in Canada and was super dominant against good players. So, yeah, depending on if those guys, if they're available, if they're going to tournaments, they could be a force as well.
Totally agree, and I think Sudsy agrees with you big time. Sudsy is on record saying that Moscoso is essentially the third or fourth best player in the world right now. But, you know, we don't know. You know, he played one tournament last year, U.S. Open, where he beat Horn and Perea, and then he played Kane tough.
Yeah.
But then in the meantime, you know, we go down to Pan Ams a few weeks ago, and he only played doubles. And then his singles compatriot, who I think is pretty safe to say is not as good of a player as Conrado, that being Carlos Keller, goes and wins the Pan Ams. So, and in the process, beating Montoya and Horn along the way. So what happens if both of those guys play the tour?
Yeah.
Kobe's a great name. You're right. He was playing well, and then he went away for his mission, and now he's back and he's been playing, but he's not, you know, but you're right. He's got wins over a number of the guys that are, you know, in the kind of the 8 to 20 range on the IRT right now. And he can play with them. Absolutely.
Yeah. So Todd, do you have any ideas for growing the sport of racquetball?
Well, you know, you can't have a sport, a thriving sport, where the demographics are essentially where they are right now. You know, you look at our sport, you go to any club, and it's a bunch of guys in their 40s and 50s out on the court, you know, huffing around. You know, there's no junior pro, the juniors are gone, the demand is gone, and so you have like this almost like this missing generation. So for me, and this is a pipe dream, and this would take a ton of money and a ton of resources, but you look at places where there's successful junior programs, and I'm talking specifically John Ellis' program in Stockton or the programs in Oregon area, And then you also look at the high school league in St. Louis, and you say to yourself, those programs should be replicatable. They should be repeatable in any major city. You know, I should be able to go to any major city and just find a few courts. You know, every university has courts that are barely used. You know, like I went to James Madison University. I know for a fact that there's like 15 courts spread around on that campus that never get used outside of, you know, PE. You know, and it's the same case for universities all around these major cities. Find people that are willing to devote the time. You know, if we had unlimited funds, we could pay them. We could have, you know, kind of juniors coordinators or high school league coordinators in all these major cities to emulate what we're doing in Portland or Stockton or St. Louis. That's how you grow it. You just make sure that there's juniors growing. If you go look, like, if you want to see what the future of a sport can look like, or maybe what it used to look like in this country, go look at the Mexican Junior Nationals draws from this past year. I think in the 18 and under, they, you know, they had a full 32 draw. And then in the 14 and unders, they had like 40 or 50 kids play on the boys' side. That's unbelievable. You know, and so why that's where the growth is. And that's frankly why we're seeing so many good Mexican male players coming up right now. And that's why we essentially see the entire LPRT dominated by women, Mexican women right now.
Yeah. What do you think we could do to emulate the growth in that area in Mexico?
This is probably a better question for, you know, Jason Thurner or, you know, somebody who's actually trying to do this. But not knowing a ton about it, I think that the starting point, we all know that courts are getting taken away, right? You know, like I live in the D.C. area, and the main chain here essentially has taken out practically every racquetball court, you know, in the entire Northern Virginia area. And we, you know, my club, I used to run a very prolific program. I had 100 people playing in a quarterly league, and that club just out and out closed. And all those people, I don't think any of them play anymore, you know? And so, you know, I think that if you want to stop getting courts ripped out, then you have to partner with the national chains. You have to go to LA Fitness. You have to go to Lifetime. You have to go to the regional chains, like say like Sport and Health here or whatever it's being called now. And, you know, forge relationships and just kind of say, look, this is a sport that can bring benefits. I think that you interviewed Winterton on one of your podcasts, and he talked about this exact same issue, and he was right. And the way that he talked about couching the argument was exactly right. You know, people bitch about the space that's lost or wasted on racquetball courts, but then they'll have a massive basketball court that just sits there idle all day long. And so you have to kind of like manage that argument. So make sure you have courts there, make sure you have programming. You know, like I have a LA Fitness membership now, and I can't take my 5-year-old back there to let him hit because there's a ban on kids under the age of 15. I get it. You know, it's insurance related, and that's the way that they keep their insurance rates down, but it's not conducive to, you know, to passing the sport along to the next generation. Focus on, you know, find some funding, find a way to pay people. You know, do you think the USTA depends on grassroots volunteers to grow its junior programs all around the country? No way. They have, those are paid positions. So why can't we have paid positions? Maybe we just need to find like a rich benefactor, kind of like the .com guys that bought the bowling tour, and depend on them to try and kind of fund things along those ways. Those are just some ideas off the top of my head.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Well, Todd, I want to be respectful of your time, so I'm going to go ahead and give you a chance to plug whatever you're interested in plugging.
Sure. So the site is www.prorecordballstats.com. I try to do pre and post tournament wrap-ups anytime there's any major event, whether it be IRT, WRT, LPRT, IRF, amateur nationals. All this data I track. So you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/prorballstats or at twitter.com/prorballstats. If you follow me there, then you'll see my updates, and then you can, I try to put in direct links to match reports or cool reports that are demonstrating something that I'm talking about. And, you know, past that, I'm always open to suggestions for new reports, you know, new ways to slice and dice the data. If you want to see different data, You know, so most of the data in the site right now is the three main pro tours. I've recently added doubles and the IRF data. I've been talking to the outdoor people to start adding the war data. I've got junior data in there and amateur nationals now, so you can kind of see. I don't have all the junior data. Like, it was just going to be too much data to try to input 8 and under multi-bounce, 6 and under multi-bounce, and all the 8 divisions going back for 30 years. But we got to start. But so that's essentially the site. And it's a labor of love. It's been going on since 2004. And I hope everybody enjoys it as much as I've enjoyed making it.
Awesome. Yeah, so everybody go check out Todd's website. Check out he has great Facebook posts leading up to different events and everything that kind of analyze what he thinks, what his predictions are, and then generally wrap ups on events. So those are great. So be sure to follow Pro Racquetball Stats on Facebook. Todd, thanks so much for coming on. Thank you for re-recording with me. And thanks for bearing with me despite my technology errors.
You bet. I hope we got it this time.
We got it, yeah. It appears that way. Yeah. I appreciate it, Todd. Thanks again.
Thanks. Thanks, Dylan.
Thank you. All right, guys. Thank you again so much for listening. I really appreciate it. As always, if you want to reach out to me to provide feedback or give, you know, your thoughts on what I could describe in the instructional segments or who you'd want to hear from, I'm working on reaching out to a bunch of people in the sport who I think would be super interesting interviews, but any suggestions would be much appreciated. You can reach out to me at dylan@racquetballshow.com. That's DYLAN@racquetballshow.com. Thanks for listening.